This is Dr. David Stevens, your host of Christian Doctor's Digest. Thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule to be with us, especially at this special time of the year. You know, this month I was just kind of sitting back and thinking about all that I had to be thankful for. You know, it's easy to focus on all you got to do. It's easy to focus on the problems that you're dealing with. And so often we really don't step back and just thank God for all the blessings He's given us. And I think it's something we should do not only in November, but periodically throughout the year. You know, as I was counting my blessings, I couldn't help but think of you. You, a CMDA member. All the many friends that I've had because of CMDA that have blessed and touched my life in special ways. And how the whole organization has networked people together to accomplish things they couldn't do alone. And you definitely fill that bill. And I was thankful for the speakers that we have on this Christian Doctor's Digest. This is a special end-of-the-year issue, and we lined up some great people that are going to teach you, going to equip you, going to inspire you to be better at what God has called you to do. Well, let's don't take any more of their time. Let's get to our first guest. It's my pleasure to welcome a very distinguished guest to the microphone, Louise Lugo, who's the director of the Pew Research Center's Forum on Religion and Public Life. He's led the Pew Forum in developing landmark surveys on religion, and right now they're working on one that's actually going beyond our borders to look at religion around the world. Prior to joining the Pew Forum, Louise served as the director of religion programs at the Pew Charitable Trust in Philadelphia. He was a professor of political science for 12 years before that and has a PhD in political science at the University of Chicago. And what I wanted to talk to him about was the nuns, those who on religious surveys are saying they have no religious affiliation. And that number is growing significantly here in the U.S. And with our burden for evangelism and outreach, we need to understand what's going on. Louis, it's great to have you on to talk about the unaffiliated, religiously unaffiliated, I guess the best way to say it, and what's happening in the United States. You guys keep such a finger on the pulse of this. What are the trends?
Well, we do indeed track these trends very closely, Dave, and what we've been seeing, including in the last 5 years where it's intensified, but even if you look at it more broadly in the last two or three decades, is a significant increase in the percentage of Americans who say they do not have any religious affiliation.
And when you say significant, what's that mean?
You go way back to the 1950s, and that would be Gallup data, not ours. We haven't been around that long. It was about 2% of Americans who said they had no religious affiliation. Today is at 20%. As recently as 5 years ago, it was at 15%. So it seems to be increasing, and increasing more rapidly than in the past.
What's the nature of those people? When you examine them, I know you dug in to try to look at who are these people. Are they atheists? Are they agnostics? Are they just uninterested? What did you find?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question, because I think it's a common misperception out there, sometimes encouraged by groups who like to pump up their numbers, that in fact all of these people are secular. You know, they're either atheists or agnostics. And that's a very important subgroup within the unaffiliated. It's almost 3 in 10 of them. But you have an equal number of people among the unaffiliated, also about 3 in 10, who in fact have a fairly significant religious pulse. If your members are used to taking pulses,
right.
You know, we take the religious pulse of the nation, and a lot of these folks have a significant religious pulse. They tell us that religion is important in their lives, that they believe in God with absolute certainty. That's about 2/3 of them, that they pray daily. So you have an equal number within that group. that in fact is fairly religious. And then the rest of them are, you could call them the religiously indifferent. They're not really against it. They're not for it. They just simply are coasting along, and they don't pay much attention to religion one way or another.
How does that look as far as ages? Are they younger, middle age, old? Is it tracking because of that, or what is the impact in socioeconomically as well and educationally? What kind of picture do you see?
Well, what we see is that, in fact, generational replacement is the single most important driving force behind these numbers. If you look at other things like, areas of the country, income level, education, yes, it's happening among all of those groups, but the most significant factor is among younger people. Those who are less than 30 years old, from 18 to 30, a third of them are unaffiliated. If you go to the other end of the age spectrum, those 65 and over, only 9% of them are unaffiliated. And as you go down by generation, they become increasingly more unaffiliated. So it is a significant age issue that's here. Now, one of the questions I'm asked all the time, Dave, is, well, but don't people get more religious as they age? And the answer is, yes, they do. People tell us religion is more important in their lives as they age. People pray more as they age. But interestingly, at least up until now, we do not see much by way of affiliation change over the lifespan of a particular generation. Generations tend to end up pretty much where they started in terms of religious affiliation.
Well, and you think of those, very old generations that went through World War II and the Depression, and is it that one of the theories out there that those who go through harder times and more difficult situations economically or wars or things like that tend to be more religious than those that have been more prosperous? Is the millennials, the young group you're talking about, have had just about everything they wanted or needed?
Well, that's a very good point. In fact, if you broaden the focus of this, we also do a lot of research on religious trends globally, and not just in the U.S. And one of the things that really highlights for you is the extent to which lower levels of religious commitment are very strongly correlated with higher levels of economic well-being. As people become wealthier, they seem to need God less in their view. And so there is, there is a very strong correlation there. People who are going through tough times, for whom it is hard day to day to make ends meet, they seem to rely much more on God than people who have it all, as it were, from an economic perspective.
And I guess we saw that after 9/11. The churches were full, but unlike World War II, that wasn't years. That was, much shorter impact on people. But it's a good illustration of what has happened. How does this affect as far as politics and things like that? I mean, are these people more on the liberal side, the conservative side? There's no difference. How's it look?
A huge difference politically that this change is having. This group, without any question, is the most liberal from an ideological perspective and the most strongly democratic from a political perspective of any other religious group. It is very, very much tilting in a liberal democratic direction by significant margins. Just to give you an illustration, I don't want to put too many numbers on you. When we ask people whether they're conservative, moderate, or liberal, if you look at this among all registered voters, we did this in the context of the last election, by an almost 2-to-1 margin, they said they were conservative rather than liberal. For the unaffiliated, however, it was precisely the reverse. By a 2-to-1 margin, they identify as liberal rather than as conservative. And this carries for sure into the social issues like abortion, same-sex marriage. The unaffiliated are significantly more liberal. I'm speaking 25, 30 points on both of those than folks who are affiliated. So it is quite a socially liberal, ideologically liberal, and democratic-leaning constituency.
What's happening as far as the main religious denominations or movements? Is it coming out of one segment where we're seeing more of these unaffiliated, or some, as you all have called the term, the nuns that have no religious affiliation? Is it happening among Catholics, among Mormons, among Protestants? And if among Protestants, where is it hitting the most?
Well, if you look at it in broad terms, that is, in aggregate terms, the percentage of the population that's accounted for by Protestants, Catholics, and the unaffiliated, let's just stick with those three groups because they are by far the largest. The trend that you see, as we've already mentioned, is the trend line for the unaffiliated going up to now about 20%. The trend line for Protestants coming down significantly. Many people may not be aware of the fact that about a year or two ago, we became, for the first time in our history, a minority Protestant country. So we have Protestants today at about 48%. As recently as the 70s, it was almost two-thirds of the population. So a lot of the folks who are populating the ranks of the unaffiliated come from Protestantism, but also from Catholicism, a good number of them. But it's not apparent when you look at these big figures, Dave, because if you look at, you know, what was the percentage of the country that was Catholic in 1972, let's say, it was about 25%. If you look at it today, it's about 25%. So it looks like there's a lot of stability in the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, nothing could be further from the truth. A lot of Catholics have left Catholicism. The difference is that all the folks who have left have been replaced by immigrants and their children. Remember, the typical immigrant to this country, including undocumented immigrants, are Christian rather than something else, like in Europe, where they tend to be much more Muslim. So those, the ranks of the immigrants have really allowed the Roman Catholic Church to remain at around a quarter of the population, even though it has experienced significant losses through people leaving the Roman Catholic Church and entering the ranks of the unaffiliated, although many of them also have converted to evangelical Protestantism.
What about when you look at the mainline Protestant groups, white mainline versus white evangelical? What are the trends there? Is it, I think our members would think, well, it obviously probably among the more liberal, those going to more liberal churches from their point of view. Is that the case or not?
Well, yes, but it's happening also among evangelical churches in terms of people gravitating towards the nuns. We've seen it in both, although your members' perception is correct that it is disproportionately coming from mainline Protestant churches. But I'm glad you used the modifier white evangelicals and white mainliners, because that's very, very important. There were two exceptions to the statement I made before that this is happening across various demographic groups. One is race. It is predominantly concentrated. This move from the affiliated to the unaffiliated is happening almost exclusively among whites in this country. If you look at the numbers for African Americans and Latinos, it's staying pretty constant. So the white modifier that you use there is indeed very important. The second thing, which was an exception to the rule that this is happening across all groups, and I think this is very, very interesting, is marriage. In the last 5 years, among folks who are married, we've not seen any increase from the affiliated to the unaffiliated. Among those who are unmarried is where we've seen all the increases. So it is an interesting thing. You begin to wonder whether a commitment is commitment is commitment, as it were, that the unwillingness of the younger generation to commit to marriage, and we know that those numbers have been going up significantly, may also be part of a piece where they have an issue with commitment to religious institutions. And actually, I think it's happening to other institutions as well. So there is a certain aversion to the kind of commitment that's called for in religious institutions and in institutions like marriage.
Do you have any data that looks at what the impact of children is? I mean, you know, anecdotally, we know it seems like couples come back to church when they start having children. And, I want to have my children to have some spiritual influence, even though I haven't been going for years. Is that the case, or is that just our impression?
Well, we don't seem to pick up much of that trend. As I mentioned before, people as they age do become more religious. And remember I mentioned that people tend to pray more. And
right.
You can well argue that, you know, those of us who have children, having kids will drive you to your knees, for sure.
More than once.
So I think the causal connection definitely is running in that direction. But in terms of actually joining, we're just not picking up, you know, much of a trend on that score.
Mm-hmm.
That once people start life out in their 20s, unaffiliated, they tend to remain that way. And if anything, it's marriage rather than having children, actually, which attracts them a little more. But again, we don't see a big difference on that score. You know, from a broader social perspective, and this involves, of course, religious organizations such as yours, the drop-off in the marriage rate, keep in mind now that it's reached to about 50% today of American adults who are married. Not surprisingly, the flip side of that is the spike in the number of children who are born outside of marriage.
Mm-hmm.
I tell people this statistics from our own Census Bureau, and they do a double take, but more than half of the children in this country today who are born to women under 30 are born outside of marriage. So it's a significant social impact that this is having on religious institutions, but on society more broadly. The fact that we are, perhaps you can say, no longer wedded to the notion of marriage as we used to be.
Louise, is there any good news in these statistics? a glimpse of anything that is a good trend, or is it all trending the wrong way?
Well, again, we take a very strong non-advocacy position.
Sure.
At the Pew Forum, so we never speak in terms of
good or
bad.
I understand. From my perspective, would there be any good?
From your perspective, it is not good news. Well, here is something. Sometimes people ask, okay, so you've looked at age cohorts, and that seems to be a proximate reason why this is changing. What's the bigger reason that this is changing? And some people have put forward the notion that we are finally catching up with Europe, or even our friends to the north, our neighbors, the Canadians, who have also gone this way, in rapid secularization. But when we look at our data, what really impresses us, Dave, is that the ranks of the unaffiliated are not coming from people who are religious. They are coming from people who are only marginally religious. So,
mm-hmm.
So let me break down the population in very rough terms. I would say that about half of Americans have a strong religious commitment. That is, they tell us religion is very important in their lives, and they attend their place of worship on a regular basis, 2 to 3 times a month. That's about 50%. Then we've talked about the other 20%, which is the unaffiliated, and then there is this middle rung, the 30% who are loosely affiliated. And they seem to be driving the ranks of the unaffiliated. But in terms of the top, that is the 50% of folks who are highly religious, unlike Europe, unlike Canada and many other countries, that number has remained quite steady over the decades.
So what would the numbers be if you're looking at Europe, like United Kingdom or Spain or other countries there? What kind of numbers would you see compared to that 50%, Louise?
It would be a fraction of that, at
yeah.
most in the teens, particularly if you combine regular church attendance as part of that. So you still have some folks who tell you religion is important in their lives, but they're less and less connected. In fact, a British sociologist coined the term, which I think is a very interesting one, believing without belonging, to characterize the situation in Europe. As I said, to some extent, that's the case for about 30% of the unaffiliated. They believe they just don't belong. In Europe, that phenomenon is much more widespread. So the way I would put it, Dave, when I'm asked by reporters and say, well, are we then becoming more secularized in that European sense? I said, well, what I see is less secularization and more polarization.
Hmm.
That is, the people who are religious and the percentage has remained steady, but the people who have become less religious has grown at the expense of that group in the middle. So I do think you tend to see, just like we're seeing some political polarization, I think you're seeing some religious polarization as well.
What are the theories of why this is happening? I mean, you've talked a little bit about secularization, and obviously that's easy to understand. Are there other theories out there that people are saying are contributing to this?
Well, one theory by very reputable scholars, people whom I respect, is that this is a kind of a backlash to the Christian right.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly, they look at the profile of the unaffiliated and how socially liberal they are, particularly on issues like homosexuality. And they have posited, because it does coincide in terms of the timing with the emergence of the Christian right. But when we ask specifically people who are unaffiliated, and we've dug very deeply into this, very few people actually tell us that. The broader reasons are questions of, people just drifted out of their tradition, just sort of stopped believing. So it wasn't a particular reaction as such. The one that I'm most impressed with is the question that I already alluded to, which is the growing disaffiliation among Americans in general. Now, maybe you go far enough back and you can say, well, this is part of our individualist philosophy in this country, where the individual and individual rights and individual expression seems to be the reigning norm. But it's happening everywhere. It's in religious institutions, as I mentioned. It's also in marriage, another important institution for society. It's also true of political parties. How have we seen the growth of the political independence? It's been the expense of Republicans and Democrats. And it's happening even, and I introduced this because I think the metaphor is so good, in bowling leagues. It was Robert Putnam at Harvard who published a book several years ago, which he entitled Bowling Alone. And his point was that, the number of people who bowl has never been higher in this country. But the bowling leagues and membership in the bowling leagues has been declining precipitously. We also have seen in recent discussions of controversies about the Boy Scouts, the decline in the numbers who are associated with scouting. So I think you're seeing, Dave, a more general phenomenon of disaffiliation. And churches and other houses of worship, other religious traditions get swept up in that. And rather than sort of bucking the trend, seem to be reflecting the trends to a significant extent. Putnam himself makes the point that he's very pessimistic when he looks backwards, although he's optimistic looking forward, because he said, look, we were here before. At the turn of the previous century, we were here, and religious institutions and others found ways to meet the needs of a new society. Frank Newport, I should mention, the president of Gallup, has come out with a book recently in which he, too, is optimistic. He thinks that the baby boomers, as they age, will become much more religious than previous generations, and will bring about, by the sheer force of their numbers, much greater levels of religiosity in this country. So there are, elements like that I think you can point to that, would give encouragement to folks like yourself. But I think the overall trend line, when you look at all religious statistics, is that things are either staying the same or declining modestly in the last few decades.
Louise, thank you for taking time out of your busy, busy schedule to enlighten us. This is just such helpful information. We need to understand our times to be able to interact with them. And, of course, we see these trends among those involved in healthcare, as we do in other areas. So thank you for taking time to be with us, and thank you for what you and Pew Forum is doing in these areas. It's enlightening to all of us.
Thank you, Dave. Anytime.
Well, I hope that's practical information you could use in your practice, in your church. But more importantly, we need to take that as a call to arms. How can we better reach those who are the nuns? There's a great book I'd recommend. It's called I Once Was Lost, What Postmodern Skeptics Taught Us About Their Path to Jesus. It's by Don Everetts and Doug Shop. And they surveyed and did questionnaires with over 2,000 postmodern people who had become followers of Christ, and they found some common themes which had emerged in how do you move people down the path to accepting the gospel. It's a great book and something that should be on your shelf and something you should read. It's available here at CMDA at 888-230-2637 or go to cmda.org. I think you'll find it very helpful. It's my delight to introduce to you Tim Gagline, who's Vice President for External Relations at Focus on the Family and a senior fellow at the Heritage Foundation in Washington. We're going to talk about his new book, The Man in the Middle, and it really looks into his life when he served as the special assistant to President George W. Bush and was the president's principal outreach contact for think tanks, veterans groups, faith-based organizations, and some of America's leading cultural organizations. But it actually goes deeper than that because we're going to dig into the spiritual lessons he learned through that process. I think you're going to find this fascinating. Tim, I just got a copy of your book, The Man in the Middle, and tell us what motivated you to write this. I'm just getting into it really well. It's excellent.
Thank you so much, Dave. Well, let me just say, the purpose of The Man in the Middle is to have given my own sort of insight and view of one of President George W. Bush's longest-serving aides. And there's a whole theoretical discussion that has taken place over many years about what is the relationship between faith and politics or religion and government or, you know, faith and public life. But I was the president's man in the middle. I was the president's chief point person with all the Christians and conservatives. And a good friend of mine who had worked in publishing for many, many years came to me several years after the Bush administration. And she said, you know, you've had a remarkable catbird seat for all those years. It would be a contribution to history if you would actually share, you know, what you saw and what you learned and what you experienced. And I came to see, Dave, that there are, in fact, a whole genre of books written not by the senior-most people or by the president and vice president, but written by people like me who were not the senior-most people, not the confidant, but who had regular and close access to the president over lots of years. And I came to see that, in fact, we could make, through the man in the middle, a contribution. And I'm very happy to say that the book has been very well received, very well reviewed. And, in fact, I think that there is a bit of a relook and a new analysis and appreciation of the Bush administration going on. And I think people like what they're seeing.
You know, you start the book with an unusual topic, the worst day of your life. And let's dig into that a little bit, because I think there's such a clear message for our listeners as Christian doctors about dealing with failure and forgiveness and mercy and a lot of things that sometimes are hard for us to deal with in our own lives.
Well, I'm glad you asked me that, Dave, and I'm glad you asked me right off the top of our interview because it's the first chapter in my book, and indeed it was the worst day of my life, and really that was a prelude to the worst chapter of my life because in the entire time that I was working with George W. Bush, loving my job, feeling it was the best job in the entire world, I was becoming a very prideful, baneful person. And, you know, I've come to see, you know, after nearly 25 years in Washington, that Potomac fever has different strains. Sometimes it's sex, sometimes it's power, sometimes it's money. In my regard, it was wanting to be, you know, the cleverest one, the one who had the best way to say it, the one who always had the right response. And I began plagiarizing columns for a newspaper that I was writing for in my hometown of Fort Wayne, Indiana. I wasn't writing about politics, I was writing about a variety of other things. But I knew what I was doing, and I was doing it regularly and routinely, and it was all my fault. It wasn't pressure. It wasn't stress. It wasn't extenuating circumstances, and it was rooted in my ego. And I came back to my desk after a breakfast at the White House, and a reporter sent me an email and says, "Is it true?" And I said to her that it was. And I fell to my desk and I prayed, oh God, because I knew it was true. And I knew that I was now going to enter into a crisis in my own life of unparalleled magnitude. And my world as I knew it was falling down around me. I had humiliated the president. I had been a hypocrite in chief to the people who had believed in me most. And of course, I had violated my integrity and my character to the most important people in my life, my wife and my two sons. And in the political classes, when you transgress in embarrassing the president, there's a kind of divorce that takes place. You are summarily cut off. And I expected that to be my case, except for the fact that I went to see the president, and I was given the words that no White House staffer wants to hear, which is the boss wants to see you. And I walked into the Oval Office after I had resigned, and I knew that this would be my proverbial woodshed moment. And I closed the door, and it was just President Bush and me, and I turned to him to apologize. And he looked me in the eyes, and he said, "You're forgiven." And I was really stunned. And I tried to apologize a second time, and he said to me, "I've known grace and mercy in my life, and you're forgiven." And I, for the third time, did apologize, and I asked him to forgive me. And I told him he should have, taken me by the lapels and thrown me into Pennsylvania Avenue for what I had done. And for a third time, he said, "You're forgiven. Grace and mercy is real. I've known grace and mercy in my life. I'm extending it to you." And he said, "We could talk about that, or we could talk about the last 8 years." And we had a remarkable session together in the Oval Office. And as I was leaving, thinking that would be the last time I would see President Bush and the Oval Office, he turned to me again and he said, "I want you to bring your wife and children here so that I can tell them what a great husband and father you have been." And I was really stunned and without words. And sure enough, a few days later, as a family, we came to the Oval Office. He extended the same grace and mercy, never mentioned my plagiarism. I had been truly forgiven. And I still cannot get to the depth of that kind of forgiveness and mercy, which was rooted categorically in George W. Bush's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And I share this because I was a broken man, broken by my own choices and broken by my own sin. And yet, at the nadir of my life, the most powerful man on planet Earth came to me and offered his unconditional forgiveness. So it's one thing to talk about faith in public life at a theoretical level, or even a philosophical level, or a constitutional level, but it's quite another to experiencing it from the President of the United States of America.
And what a great analogy, of how God works with us. And here's the greatest man on earth. The God of the universe does the same. But to see that actually happen in your own life. How did other people react to him? I mean, I'm sure it was devastating to your family and colleagues and friends. The president stepped back and gave you forgiveness. How about others?
May I say that, yes, others did and do forgive, beginning with my wife and son, beginning with friends and colleagues who I had disappointed and who rightfully were frustrated and concerned. And, it's a process. Forgiveness is a process. It's not a snap your fingers, let's start again, push the proverbial reset button.
Yeah.
And so I've come to see that forgiveness is a process. For some people, it takes a long time. For other people, less time. The good thing is that it's all God's time.
Mm-hmm.
And part of redemption is being patient and knowing that God only wants the best thing to happen to us, and that we have to be patient and trust that His time and His ways are not always our time and our ways. But we have to have that faith.
What did God teach you through the whole process? Of going through that.
He taught me, in the words of the poet T.S. Eliot, that humility is endless, that pride does go before the fall, that pride is a sin, that despair is a sin, that humility is a part of service, humility is an extension of the Christian life, that pride is no part of the Christian life, that life is about service preeminently. And that in Washington and in New York and in Tuscaloosa and Littletown and Big Town and wherever, that we all have a vocation and we are to be mindful that in that vocation, we are to resist the temptation toward being the smartest one, the brightest one, the one that's most eloquent, most fluid, whatever, that our goal is not the success of this world, but it's obedience to God, and to understand that the Westminster Confession of Faith was correct, that the purpose of the Christian life is to know God and to serve Him forever and to be confident that that's enough.
Yeah, those are great insights, and you've been through the valley. Those are deeply ingrained when you've been through the valley as you have. One of the chapters that really sprung out to me in the book, because I remember, you know, you talk about stem cells and the day the president gave his speech, and you were in on all of that. I remember I was actually in Washington in a hotel waiting for NPR to call me for an interview as soon as that was over. Take us to that whole process. I think it would be fascinating, kind of as an illustration of so many of these views into the White House that you give in the book, of just what happened in the process of President Bush making that decision and then what followed.
I'm thrilled you ask about that, Dave, because there's a reason that I devote an entire chapter to stem cell research. And the reason I did and do, and I'm eager for people to read this in The Man in the Middle, is because I think that that was one of the truly turnkey foundational moments of the Bush administration. President Bush had a major decision to make. And off of stem cells comes biotechnological questions, bioethical questions, questions of cloning, and really, it turned out to be, you know, one of the most pro-life decisions of any president ever. And by the way, in The Man in the Middle, I talk at length why I believe George W. Bush is the most pro-life, pro-marriage, pro-religious liberty president of any in the contemporary presidency and without peer. But on the stem cell decision, I wanted to show that George W. Bush wanted to hear all opinions. He wanted to hear and consider all sides. He wanted to have views from people who he was naturally inclined to agree with, and he wanted to hear from people who he was disinclined to agree with. He took a long time to decide. That's the other thing. This was not a snapshot decision. It wasn't a political decision, and it was not a quick decision. It was a thoughtful, modeled way in which, you know, chief executives and presidents ought to make decisions of this import. And I believe that historically he will be vindicated both in the way and the method in which he made the decision, but also for the decision itself. And the fact that most presidents use primetime speeches to talk about major foreign and security policy, the fact that he used it to talk about domestic policy and to talk about the pro-life decision, I think, was a monumental achievement.
He met a lot of criticism, and some of it from both sides of the spectrum after he made that. And one of your jobs was to be the communicator with the faith-based community and conservative community across the country. How did that all play out?
The answer is that it played out in a mixed way, but people who were not inclined to be our allies actually came to see the value and the utility of the decision and came around. That is to say, a lot of quarters where we did not expect to find support, we found strong support. And in many quarters where we thought that we, you know, would have natural allies, there was a lot of genuine skepticism. And I write about this in The Man in the Middle. This was one of those areas where I thought that the fault lines would be brighter than they actually were.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, all these years later, when people talk about the most important pro-life decisions of the Bush administration, I find repeatedly that all those roads lead back to that speech at Prairie Chapel Ranch where the president announced the decision, and all the avenues lead back to the many ways in which this decision impacted so many others in medicine, in healthcare, in research and development. And by the way, it's possible, in my opinion, Dave, that the biotech, bioethical stem cell decision is the most under-discussed, under-appreciated theme of our era. What is happening in the States, what's happening at NIH here in Washington, it's all very big and, in my opinion, worthy of a greater discussion.
Yeah, true. What do you hope the book's going to accomplish? I mean, when you sit down and you pen that last word, and I've written a couple books, I know that's a big day in your life when you get to the end of such a large project. What do you hope this is going to accomplish in those that read it?
that America's best days are ahead. They're not behind us.
Mm-hmm.
I finished the book talking about an American renaissance. A very great president once said everybody's entitled to his own opinions, but not everyone's entitled to his own facts. And so I was very eager in this last chapter not to assert my opinions about things, but to look at a metric and to say there is a way forward. And I believe very strongly that faith and the public square go together. I believe, Dave, that our founders were right, that if you want a country with lots of liberty, have a public square that is nourished by faith, virtue, and moral excellence in the people. Our founders were very different men, and men as different as Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson, who disagreed on gigantic things. They agreed on one big thing, and that is that our liberty did come from God and from Providence and not from government, and that in the American experience, you had to have large amounts of virtue, which is moral excellence, to allow liberty to flourish, and that if you wanted lots of liberty, find lots of way to nourish moral excellence. And in the American experience, that comes from the Judeo-Christian tradition. In my opinion, that's the way forward, not the way back.
Yeah. Tim, I want to thank you for taking time out of your very, very busy schedule to be with us and for what you've done in this book. I think you've given us a wonderful insight into a period that almost all of us lived through, behind-the-scenes look, and more importantly, just really enforce some very basic principles and that we believe in that we can now see how they're lived out in the courts of power. And then the aspect of how you began, and actually in the book, talking about forgiveness and mercy and what we do and should do when we mess up, when we don't do what we should, was just a great inspiration, a blessing to me, and I know it's going to be to many people that are listening. So thanks for taking some time with us.
Dave, thanks so much, and I hope people will read The Man in the Middle and get a new insight into this remarkable president and this very, very important presidency.
God bless.
God bless you.
You know, no matter what your political party bent is, we all want to honor Christ. And it's great to kind of give this inside view of what was going on at the White House. But more importantly, the spiritual lessons that Tim learned. All of us have difficulties and all of us screw up at times. And isn't it good to know that God forgives us? And also, our opportunity to promote moral excellence. I think that's something we can actually do with our patients. And it may be through example, it may be through our words, it may be through the resources we give, and it may be through sharing the gospel with the patients in your office. Some of you may have done the saline solution. I'm happy to let you know that that's being updated, expanded, and it's going to be called the Grace Prescription, something that every healthcare professional should go and experience. And you go and experience that at a conference, or actually it's going to be a small group video series that you can use with your colleagues, a small group in your home, or even with the staff in your office. Stay tuned. There'll be more about that pretty soon. If you're a resident or a dental student that's graduating, don't forget about CMDA's placement service. It's a huge challenge to think about, where am I going to practice? Where am I going to find time to screen all the possibilities? Where do even those places exist that are looking for people just like me? Well, the CMDA placement service will answer all those questions and much, much more. And then if you're in practice and you need a colleague, you need a physician, a dental colleague, a nurse practitioner, a PA, just give us a buzz. The placement service is expert in finding the kind of colleague to join you that will not only be excellent in the care they provide, but share your worldview and have your Christian commitment. We have hundreds of stories of how that has happened, and these folks really know what they're doing. If you'd like to get in touch with them, just give us a call at 888-230-2637, and they'll be delighted to talk to you. Also, we got a couple great conferences coming up. The Winter Conference, February 21st through the 23rd this year, will be at CMDA's headquarters and features Richard Swenson. He's going to be focusing in on his latest book called Contentment. It's the best thing he's ever written, and you know how good a writer Dick is. I've been giving this book out to everybody I know, and it's just marvelous, something that we really need to reflect on and apply into our lives. And Dick's going to just kind of open not only the book, but much more than that at the Winter Conference. For more information, go to cmda.org or give us a call here at the office. And then don't forget the National Conference this year in a beautiful Green Lake, Wisconsin, a gorgeous resort. The dates are April 24th through the 27th. We've got a great lineup of speakers, good fellowship. Everybody that comes say, wow, what a fantastic time of renewal in my life, as well as great networking, wonderful education, and growing in my faith in Jesus Christ. To find out more, check out the website or give us a call. We'd be happy to send you a brochure. For many of you, you don't need introduction to Dr. Al Weir. You've known Al as the president of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. You've known him as the vice president of campus and community ministries for 3 years here at CMDA. Maybe if you're involved in missions, you know him as president of the Albanian Health Fund and outreach to Albania that CMDA has been involved with in many years. Some of you read his book, When the Doctor Has Bad News, or picked up one of his articles that he's written in today's Christian Doctor or one of our other publications. These days, Al is the professor of medicine at University of Tennessee Health Science Center and the program director for their Hematology Oncology Fellowship Program. I asked him to join us so that we could tell you a little bit about his weekly devotional, which now has over 3,500 of our members reading it every week. You should be reading it as well. Let's find out why. Al, you've been doing a devotional for CMDA, and it's just been fantastic to see how this thing has grown and then touched so many lives. Tell those who may not be familiar with it a little bit about what moved you to do this and what your real goals were.
Well, for the last, 20 years of my life, my main goal personally was to learn how to be a Christian doctor, and it's been a great adventure. But in doing so, I have developed a habit of constantly watching my day and looking to see where God is working, and then trying to understand how does that impact the way I live. Out of that has come sort of this habit of when I see patients asking what God is doing, and then perhaps writing down little stories about the patients when I see them, and then later praying about them and reading God's scripture and coming together with an idea about what God was trying to tell me in that patient encounter, or encounter with my wife, or encounter with my kids, or encounter with my colleagues. So it's mainly a matter of watching my day and looking to see where God is working, and then trying to put it down in words.
You know, I don't think there's anything like this. I've never seen anything like it. It's so applicable to those in the healthcare professions in really applying God's word directly into what we experience every day, the stresses, the strains, the opportunities, the blessings, the pathos of the difficult situations we deal with patients, and it's just marvelous. How do you go about that on a weekly basis? I know it comes out towards the end of the week. You kind of sit down and put it all together, I'm sure, after a lot of prayer and study.
Sometimes it comes from an encounter with a patient. I'll jot down a little note and put it in my pocket, and then put that up on the computer, and each day look at it and try to say, where is God speaking to me through this, and then type a little bit, and then maybe a week later type a little bit, and as God shows me what he's doing. Sometimes it comes from a book I'm reading or a message that I hear in the sermon, and then I watch throughout the week to see, okay, God, how does this really apply to a doctor as he's going through his life? And so I work on a little bit of time. A given devotion may take me 3 or 4 weeks, but they sort of pile up because they may come 2 or 3 start a day, and then Gradually, I'll put them together as God shows me what he's trying to tell me. These are basically messages to myself.
Yeah.
I'm pretty much an ordinary doctor, and therefore I hope that what I experience in God's work is what other doctors experience.
Well, God speaks through what he's teaching you to teach us. What kind of feedback are you getting from those that are reading this? I know the numbers are in the thousands now that get this free devotional every week through the CMDA system. What kind of feedback you get?
Well, you know, periodically we'll get an email feedback from a doctor who has read it and it's been important in his life and his or her given situation in life. I'll run across people who will tell me, I read your devotions and you know, I think God's speaking through them. I don't look for feedback. I don't get lots of fan mail, nor do I want it. But every now and then when I try to figure out whether it's worth continuing writing these things, someone will speak up and I say, okay, God, I'll keep going with it.
Well, and I know one of our goals we're getting fairly close to is to turn this into a devotional book or an app or something that people can go back and read the ones that have been coming out for literally a good number of years now. Al, I want to thank you for what you've done, your faithfulness to let God speak through you, and what he's teaching you has taught each one of us. Just thank you for your faithfulness in the midst of an incredibly busy practice and family life like all of us have, to be faithful to minister to us. What a blessing that's been.
Well, it's such a privilege for me for God to have allowed me to be a doctor in this life, and I just pray that I'm living it out each day a little better than I did before.
These devotionals have been a real blessing and a challenge to me, and I know they will be to you as well. If you'd like to get on the list and you're not there, just email communications@cmda.org. Give your name and email, and they'll get you signed up. I'm especially excited to bring Erin Brin to the microphone. She's a busy wife, the wife of a busy doctor, mother of six with a passion for life and adventure. She has a degree in elementary education and special education. And she did something most moms, most teachers have never done, and that is she packed up two of her children, went halfway around the world, and lived in Afghanistan with her husband for a year. She reflects on that in her extraordinary book, Finding Roses in the Dust. And wow, it is a blockbuster as far as I'm concerned. After I read it, I took it home and my wife read it and immediately began ordering copies to give away to our daughters, to other people. In fact, this book may bankrupt me. I don't know the rate she's going. And I've given it to others as well. Let's talk to Erin about it. I think you're going to get some insights just from this interview. They're going to stimulate you to say, I've got to read this book. Erin, it's great to have you join me for Christian Doctors Digest. I had the pleasure of endorsing your new book, Finding Roses in the Dust, and it was just marvelous. What led you to put this all down, your story of your time in Afghanistan?
Wow. Well, first of all, thank you for having me today. What an honor and pleasure it is to get to talk to you about this amazing journey and wonderful gift that really I received. But we had the incredible opportunity of living overseas in Afghanistan for a year with our family. And the Lord just taught me so many things through life there. And I wrote letters home to my friends and family describing life and what we were doing every day. And I got questions all the time to explain further about the culture and the people and the life there, and realized that the stories that people were hearing in America were nothing like the reality of life in that country. Most of the information that we get every day is through a filter of media. And I just felt like the true story of Afghanistan wasn't being heard, wasn't being told. And when we came home and I reflected on this amazing gift that we had been given and the insights and the incredible principles that the Lord had taught me through life there, I really felt impressed that he wanted me to be an ambassador in a way, to tell the story for people who don't have a voice, to explain to people here in the West what life is really like in Afghanistan for a wife, for a mother, for a father, a son, who's just trying to survive every day in a country that is riddled by civil war and addictions and fear. I had been given a gift to live in a place that very few people have ever seen, and I felt it was a responsibility, a duty of mine, to pass that on, and really in hopes that people would get on their knees and pray.
Let's talk about how it all began. I mean, did William come home one day and say, honey, you want to go to Afghanistan? Or, I mean, exactly how does this happen? You know, this isn't the normal thing that most people go through, and even the decision, I'm sure, was huge, and you talk about that in the book.
It was. It was a big deal. But we had had the opportunity 5 years earlier to visit the country and to partner in a work being done there to teach Afghan physicians, and had kind of had our hands in that back and forth. And really through a group of circumstances, the director of an educational program there that we were affiliated with was going to step down, and there was going to be a kind of a hole in the administration. And we were approached about the possibility of coming over and filling that gap. And it came out of the blue, and yet at the same time, in my spirit, man, it really wasn't out of the blue. I mean, when we talked about it, it was shocking, and I couldn't believe we were having the conversation. Yet when I was still and quiet, I knew that it was the Lord. But we got a call one morning and said, you know, would you consider doing this? And we both said that we would pray about it. And we just set it on the table. And we were coming home from our son's graduation. And it just kept coming up in me and kept coming up in me. And I finally said to my husband, so what about Afghanistan? What are we going to do? And he said, I think we're supposed to go. And that just started a whole crazy series of events and questions and wrestling. You know, are we really supposed to do this? Are we really supposed to take our family to a country at war and live there? And what about our kids? And what about school? And what about our job? So as we began to wrestle with all that, the Lord began to answer all those questions for us. And within a series of about, 6-8 weeks, we had made the final decision to go, and within about 10, 12 weeks, we were on a plane heading over there.
How'd that make you feel? I can't imagine the feeling. You went with not all your children, just some of them. What were the emotions that were raging as you got on that plane, and maybe even more so when you got off the plane?
Well, I went through the full gamut. You know, when we first decided to go, I was really consumed with fear. God, really, are you asking me to do this? I can't. I'm not capable. I can't leave 4 of my children at home who are in university or post-university. I can't take 2 of my kids to a country at war. That's not responsible. You know, God, I can't go with all these unknowns. Really, I'm not able. Don't ask me, you know. And one morning I was getting ready for the day, and I was wrestling with that very thing. Lord, really, are you really asking me to do this? I don't think I can do this. And I just felt this still small voice inside of me say, you know, you don't have to be afraid of this. It's not that I'm making you do this. You get to do this. This is a gift. This is an opportunity. You get to partner with me in the plans that I have for these people. And it just all changed on a dime for me. And then I was so excited, and really the Lord just graced me for the process, all the crazy details that it took to get us there through visas and schools and just different things that we had to jump through to get there, that by the time I got on the plane, I was really relieved and super excited to be starting on this adventure. Of course, as I stepped off of the plane, some of those feelings definitely came back, as I realized I was one of only 2 other women in the whole immigration line, and those other women were Afghan women, and I had the only children with me there, and everyone else were men staring at us, wondering what the heck is this American family doing in our country. Then there was some fear and anxiety, just wondering how it was all going to play out. But my overall emotion, I think, at that point was just excitement. Just, wow, we get to do this. We get to be a part of something very few people ever even get to see. And the Lord chose us, and it was a huge honor.
How did this affect you as a woman in a Muslim culture? I know there were enormous changes in all areas of your life, but that must have been one of the greatest.
Yeah, it really was. It was the biggest surprise, I think, for me. I did a lot of research on the country. I paid attention to the customs and the religious preferences of Islam. We were very respectful of that. I veiled while I was there. My daughter and I were both completely covered. But the lack of independence and the suppression of women, even though I knew it in my head, was a pretty crazy reality once I lived it. Most days I was in the house 24/7. I couldn't leave unless I had an escort with me, and that had to be a male escort. It could either be my older son or my husband, or maybe one of the guards that worked within our compound. I was expected to not speak to men at all, to make eye contact with men. I walked a few steps behind whatever escort or man that was with me. I was never allowed to ride in the front seat of a car. I always had to ride in the back, even if I was the only passenger. I couldn't shop alone. I had to go with my husband every week. We had a specific day that we went out shopping, and he did all of the conversing with the shopkeepers, and it was a really different lifestyle for me. In America, I drive my own car. I do my own shopping. I'm very independent. I can speak to whoever I want to. I can have conversations with men and women. But in that country, it's very different. And it made me sad. Sometimes it was really frustrating. I felt lonely a lot of the times. This isolation that I had from the rest of the world and this lack of identity except through my husband was really new and different. And yet it really gave me a sensitivity to the women there. It was very interesting when I would walk on the street, especially in the market. There was never a lot of women, but there were always some. And if we would pass one another and I would glance up and we would catch each other's eye, there was this kind of general understanding between us that there was a sisterhood in a weird way between the women there, you know. And even though I was foreign and was from a different country, there still was this general understanding of what life was like. So it was very different, and it was hard at times. My liberties, my freedoms were something that I literally hung on a hook every day when I hung up my abaya and my chador, which is what I had to wear every day when I left the house. And when I came into my home, I could take that off, and life was normal. But when I left every day, my identity was under that black cloak and that scarf. And it was something, again, few Western women get to experience, but it was something that was a surprise to me. I didn't realize that it would affect me quite as much as it did.
What did God teach you through this experience? And I know that's a very big question, but if you picked out the two, three things that God just impressed on you during that year that would be important to share with those that are listening, especially the women, but all of us, what would you say?
I think the biggest thing that God taught me was to really step back and look at life through the lens of His eye and not my eye of experience or prejudice or education or whatever it is that I think gives me identity or creates identity in the world in which I live, that God gave me opportunity over and over again to just step back and say, you know, I see life a little differently than you. And if you'll remove yourself and your flesh and your feelings and your preferences, then I can begin to show you what I see and how I feel. That's really when I began to fall in love with the people of Afghanistan and to see them in a whole new way. You know, in America, we're taught really through the media and through our experiences and interactions here to be afraid of Islam, to be afraid of Muslims, to be afraid of Afghanistan in particular, because there's only one picture that's painted. And even though I wanted to go to Afghanistan, I wanted God to use me there, I still carried some of that fear and those prejudices inside my heart. And as God began to break that down and began to show me how He sees people, He opened up my eyes to a whole new perspective about life in general. You know, people that offend you, people that hurt you, that say things or are having a bad day, or just interactions in general. If we're able to step back and see people the way God does and remove ourselves from that, then we're able to walk in forgiveness and in love. And I mean, I still struggle with that every day, just like anybody who lives in their body of flesh does. But God really gave me revelation to that, reminded me over and over that, especially the people of Afghanistan, but all people in general, are His creation. They're His children. And He created them in His image, and His desire is for them to be reconciled to Him. Many are deceived in that process. They're deceived by fear and by culture and by religion, and His heart is grieved for that. So that really created a freedom in my heart as I interacted with people, and I walked out a life that was very foreign to me and very different for me. So I think that has to be the biggest thing for me.
What else did He teach you?
Yeah, He taught me really to be patient with life, and that my worth and my identity is not wrapped up in what I do and what I accomplish. You know, life in Afghanistan is really different than America. It's very slow. It's very deliberate. It's based on relationship. In America, everything is based on production. Who we are, what we do, how that gets accomplished, how quickly that gets accomplished. When we check off 20 things on our list every day and when we lay down to go to bed at night, we feel pretty good about ourselves. But in Afghanistan, that's different. First of all, because of the restriction of freedom and availability and stuff, life is a lot slower and simpler. And there are lots of days that you can't check off very many things on your list. Maybe the electricity's out. Maybe the water is out. Maybe there's no heat that day. Maybe there was a bomb threat and everybody is on lockdown in their house. You know, there are things that are uncontrollable there that cause you to step back and measure your time and your life and your productivity a lot differently. And we really learn to relate relationally in that country far better than we do here in America. Americans are very private, and they like their space and their lives very organized. In Afghanistan, people are all about relationship. They're all about helping one another raise their kids or work at their job, and they take time to sit and speak to one another. So I specifically really had the opportunity to just sit back and recognize what was really true and valuable in life and how God desires to work in us and through us. Sometimes those things aren't about checking off on lists. Sometimes those are about interacting with people or being quiet and listening and being available to hear His voice. And we don't have a lot of opportunity for that in America. So that was a really huge lesson, I think, I learned, just to step back and breathe and get rid of the clutter.
Aaron, you're such a gifted writer, and I think people can tell that from how articulate you are in this interview, but the stories, the insights, the things you share in the book are just gripping, and I highly, highly recommend it for everyone. Let me ask you this. When you finish this, and I know how big a project writing a book is, I haven't done three of them now, what did you hope this is going to accomplish? If God graces all the hard work that you've done, what do you want to see this book do in people's lives?
I really want them to have God's perspective. I want them to have the gift that God gave me to see life differently. And they may never have an opportunity to live in a third world country, certainly most likely won't have an opportunity to live in Afghanistan. So I want them to glean from that. I want them to take my experiences and the things that maybe I struggled with or had triumph in and be able to transfer that into their own life. I really believe that the things that God taught me, and truly all of us as we walk out life, God teaches us things every single day, and I don't think they're ever just for us. I think that that's always God's heart, is that whatever we learn and glean from and grow in, that we share that and that we pass that on and that we challenge one another in that process. I mean, God does and has and will continue to show himself supernaturally in people's lives, and even through visions and dreams and dramatic encounters. But most of the time, God just uses people. He just uses our hands and our feet and our mouth to represent him and to connect him to others. And so if my experiences and the things that God taught me by living a very ordinary life in a very extraordinary way can push people towards him or encourage them to think outside the box of their own little life, then I think I've accomplished what the goal of the book is.
I think you're going to accomplish that, because I know it did it with me. Aaron, thank you for being with us, and I'm just praying that a lot of folks are going to enjoy a very, very good read.
Oh, well, thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's such an honor and a pleasure to just get to share these gifts that God's given us. I'm just very grateful. Thank you.
As I mentioned, my wife's giving a lot of these away, so I'm not going to give you my personal phone number at the house. I'm going to give you CMDA's number. Don't waste any time. Get the book right now and call us at 888-230-2637. Or if you prefer, go to the bookstore on cmda.org, and that book will be speeding your direction. One of the fun things I did when I was a missionary was to take my 13-year-old son with a group of other missionary dads, and we climbed Mount Kenya. And it was a two-day trip to get there, and we actually took off the second day at 2 o'clock in the morning and arrived right at the summit of the mountain as the sun rose. And literally, you could see all the way to Mount Kilimanjaro. I had a perspective of Kenya that I'd never had before, and it was gorgeous. I was thinking about that as I was thinking about mentioning our year-end needs. The end-of-the-year financial income is so important to CMDA's health. But I was thinking in that way because, you know, you have a perspective of CMDA from where you live and what you experience. I live at the top of the mountain. I get to look 360 degrees and see those over 47, 48 different ministries now that we have around the world. See the impact that they're having in people's lives. I wish I could take you up the mountain to where I live every day, seeing what God is doing. Just this past week, we hosted through the Center of Medical Missions leaders from mission organizations from across the country that are involved in medical missions. What a phenomenal 2 days. I just got a note from one of the leaders there talking about he had taken 3 pages of notes of things he needed to talk to his team and his ministry about in their mission that he had learned just from the networking and the talks and the discussion that happened during those 2 days. CMDA increasingly is at the hub of what is happening in medical missions around the world in recruiting and training and sustaining medical missionaries. And then I get a note from someone on a campus and how their life's been transformed. And you begin to multiply that times the 249 different campuses and the literally 10 to 15,000 students that are involved in CMDA events every week. And then I open an email and it's from John Embody, and we're signing on to a brief trying to preserve religious speech in an important case in Massachusetts this morning. And he's speaking to the trafficking ambassador on human trafficking in his office later today. And these things are just coming at me as I stand on top of the mountain. I can see so much of what the impact is, more than I could ever do by myself, as God has provided with us just a marvelous, committed staff who is determined to spread the gospel, to speak truth into people's lives, to carry the gospel around the world through medical missions. And God is doing that in just a marvelous way. I'm more enthused about CMDA than I've ever been. In fact, this past year I gave the largest gift I've ever given to CMDA, a very sacrificial gift, because I so much wanted to see this ministry expand. And so when I talk about supporting, I'm not talking academically. I'm talking about something I'm doing. And what I'm saying to you at the end of this is simply this. This is worth your prayers. This is worth your involvement. This is worth your support, your sacrificial support, because there's no other organization like us to do it. The local church can't do what we do. Other nonprofits can't do what we do. And God is blessing and expanding our horizons as never, never before. I'm so excited that I get to be here on the mountain watching it all happen as God works in people's lives and changing hearts. So as we approach this end of the year, I trust you'll be generous. I trust you'll open your checkbook or transfer some appreciated stock or give some land or whatever God lays on your heart. It doesn't have to be just cold hard cash, but this is a critical time of the year. Depending on how the year end goes is what we're able to do during the rest of our financial year and how far we have to pull in our belts if it doesn't go well. So give by credit card on the web. You can send us a check. If you'd like to talk about an appreciated asset, just call our stewardship department. As you give, more importantly, as you pray, God is going to continue to expand this ministry, touch many more lives, and change the heart of healthcare. If we ever needed it, we need it now. Together, we can make a difference. Don't delay. And be assured, too, that we're here to serve you. That's why we exist. To hold up your arms as you fight that battle every day, just as Moses' arms were held up. We know it's impossible to do it alone. We need each other, praying with each other, encouraging each other, equipping each other. And CMDA is the hub for doing that. It's our joy to serve Him. It's our joy to serve you. And as we approach this end of the year, I'm praying God's going to pour out His richest blessings on you and your family. May this be a special time as you thank God for what He's accomplished, and as you look forward to celebrating His birth. God bless.
Christian Doctors Digest is a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on Christian Doctors Digest are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on Christian Doctors Digest reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.